Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority.
My guest today is the Christian theologian and philosopher Don Cupid. Hello, Don. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hello.
Okay, can we start by you telling us how you understand religion?
In the past, I think, people tended to see reality as a hierarchy of powers with God the supreme being at the top. So you started with a kind of mythical or metaphysical account of reality, and then religion was a matter of relating yourself to the world, so you fitted in. And this meant worshipping God and serving God and so on. Religion was adapting yourself to reality. I now take a rather different view. I link religion more with the imagination of how there might be a better world and order of relations than we have now. So for me, religion involves a dream and living by a dream. The dream in Christianity is traditionally the kingdom of God. Live as if in the kingdom of God. Live as if a life based on love is possible, and you're trying to live it. And perhaps you'll gradually bring it into being. So for me, religion involves living inspired by a myth or living a dream.
Yeah, so living also very much in the present as opposed to some future.
Yes, I'm just short of 80 years old, so I haven't got long. After that, I'll be extinct for all eternity. As a result, I think I should live hard while I've got a little time left.
Okay. you use the term non-realism. What is non-realism about God?
Belief that God does not exist independently of the human mind. All knowledge is relative to human beings and the human mind. We have no knowledge of a world that exists totally independent of ourselves and our descriptions of it. Now, realism was normal in Western thought up to about the time of Kant. Since then, we've gradually changed over and realized that the world exists within human knowledge, not human knowledge within the world. A non-realist view of God sees God as an ideal, a spiritual ideal, an inspiration, perhaps something like the pearl of great price, a star, a dream to live by. So from about 1980, I kept the word God as a spiritual ideal, but dropped the idea of God as creator and first cause of the universe. That kind of language is meaningless and cannot now be used. We should look to science to tell us about how things began. We should look to religion to tell us how we should orient our lives.
Okay. Are you sympathetic in this regard to understanding God in archetypal terms, in Jungian terms?
Yes, God is the wider self we're struggling to become. I quite like the idea of breaking the bounds of the narrow self and becoming more, in a sense, detached and open to a larger, wider reality than ourselves as we get old and die. So I do think Jung, of all recent thinkers, is the one who has the most interesting view of getting older and death, the second half of life.
How would you understand the relationship between non-realism and agnosticism?
The non-realist tends to see religious truth as picture language, as mythical, but as life-guiding, regulative or life-guiding. Agnosticism is a rather different view. It's agnostic about metaphysical knowledge. We don't claim any metaphysical knowledge, nor are we dogmatically against it. We simply set it aside. Whereas non-realism usually takes a regulative view of religious truth. You need to have some kind of picture of something beyond your present experience that you're aiming for. Think of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream, which expressed very well, I think, the American blacks longing for a better world, longing for liberation in a particular historical context. That very, very inspiring speech ultimately goes back to the preaching of Jesus about the kingdom of God, but it's got a lot of black history also woven into the form the speech eventually took. But that's a good example, I think, of religious yearning in modern terms.
in that sense, can you see objectivity in a moral sense incrementally? You know, like how we use the term in everyday speech, you know, come on, be more objective about this.
Yes, you mean as when people use an approximationist view of scientific truth, they think that in science we're getting gradually closer to our objectivity as our theories improve. Yes, I give up that idea. I think that all there is out there is a kind of empty flux of becoming, which our language turns into a world, and we agree a picture of the world by our conversation among ourselves, but we should give up the idea of objectivity.
Okay.
Sorry, objectivity totally independent of ourselves. We can never leave our own language and our own humanity entirely behind. We're always inside ourselves. We don't know any other world than the world of human life. It's where we start. It's where our whole lives are lived. We never get out of it.
Have you been influenced by Wittgenstein in this regard?
Amongst others, yes. Actually, the changeover from the traditional metaphysical realism to today's view gradually starts to take place through Kant and Hegel and the debate since. Great figures include Nietzsche, Heidegger, Wittgenstein, and Derrida. These are the main modern thinkers. It's something like a journalist's view of the world. The world in language on your breakfast table in the newspaper every day. That's the nearest we get to objectivity, a human perspective within a human perspective.
I suppose you could say Wittgenstein saw meaning as created by the use of words within the conventions of society.
That's right, yes. Nowadays I make philosophy of life, our basic philosophy, and I start by analysing the way the words are used in ordinary language. Because ordinary language was our first great intellectual feat, was to learn our own mother tongue. And after that, ordinary language remains extraordinarily interesting, and you can discover which way human beings are going spiritually by looking at the changes currently taking place in ordinary language.
Have you ever come across the theory of embodied meaning by Lakoff and Johnson?
No, I haven't, no.
Okay, well, we'll leave that one then. How did you reconcile being an ordained priest of the C of E and not believing in a realist God?
Well, there are some questions about the Bible itself. Oddly enough, if you have a look at the first epistle of St. John in the New Testament, that more or less equates God with love. It seems to say that God is love and to mean love is God, i.e. God is a spiritual ideal, love that you live by and for the sake of. Or think of St. Paul at Athens saying God is that within which we live and move and have our being. God is everything, the whole of life. Life is God, even. So the roots of a non-realist view of God can be found in the Bible too. I am, by the way, still today an ordained priest of the Church of England at the age of 79 and 11, 12. I've kept there because all my friends are there and my primary market is the Church of England, which used to be a rather intellectual church. Yep. A lot of Anglicans, historically, have always liked Plato and they've always liked the Quakers. We've always liked the idea of demythologizing Christianity.
Now, the publication of the book Taking Leave of God in the late 70s was a real turning point in your life. Have the Christian community now, in the UK at least, come round at all more to your views than they did then in the 80s?
A great many theologians privately agree with me, but you can't say so publicly.
Right.
It's true that Taking Leave of God came out in 1980. It finished my career, and in a sense, you're an outcast after that. You can't be promoted in either the church or the academy. You get marginalized. Nevertheless, you have to battle on and build up a literature, and that's what I've done. I'm at present writing my 50th book. I'm battling away to establish a large body of work to try to persuade the church that it cannot go on drifting more and more into irony, i.e. knowing very well this message isn't true, but refusing to modernize it. In a curious way, the church both believes and disbelieves its own message. That's a postmodern church we've got. We're not serious about believing that Jesus ascended bodily into heaven. That's what's in the creed. But nobody thinks that heaven is a world up in the sky where human beings walk about in bodies.
Yeah, you saw yourself marginalised, Don, but for many people, that book was a watershed. And there's a view that you were a real pioneer, especially being able to see religion, while shorn of belief, as still something very valuable.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I'm very concerned with the future of religion. I very much want there to be a go-on being religion, and certain features of Christianity, above all the figure of Jesus and his humanitarian ethics. Those things have got to be preserved. So it is for me vital that I do something for the future of Christianity. The people in the churches at the moment who count themselves as Orthodox are not doing anything to create a Christian future. They're merely holding on to a declining Christian past, which is fading away very fast. Mm. And by the way, if you notice, amongst the churches, Christianity is nowadays little more than church-going. That's all they seem to want. That's all they talk about. Church-going. Well, church-going by itself is not religion.
Your views, what you're just saying now, in some way, to me, relate to how Kierkegaard felt in the 19th century about the Danish church. Can you see any correlation there?
Well, for many years, I was strongly influenced by Kierkegaard and admired his individualism, his very high level of consciousness, and his account generally. I've moved away from individualist existentialism now. I don't think the self lasts that long, and I think we've got to become even more post-metaphysical than Kierkegaard himself.
Okay.
We've got to accept that we're transient parts of a flux. Everything flows, everything pours out and passes away, carrying us with it. We are not immortal.
Okay. How do you think non-realist Christians should understand then the status of Jesus?
He's a teacher, and he teaches that if you start to live a life of love without resentment, without any negative or hostile feelings to anybody, you can begin to live a new kind of life in a new world. That's the coming of the kingdom of God. It'll be there when we choose it and start to live it. And I very much admire the early teaching of Jesus and his example. I still do. I'm a fellow of the Jesus Seminar in California and have attended some of their conferences and so on, and keep in touch with their work. I'm primarily a philosopher, but I'd like to keep the ethics of Jesus. By the way, notice there, in our own society, there's still a lot of people who want revenge. When they use the word justice, they really mean revenge. And they nag away till they get it. They want to see somebody else suffering.
Yeah.
But for me, the key saying of Jesus, the one that really is his, is love your enemy. Can you live without hating anybody? And without having hostile, negative feelings about anybody, can you be completely solar, I call it, just pouring yourself out and passing away? I say that the self is to be expended. We should live as the sun does. We should come out and put on a good show and pour ourselves out into the flux of life.
You've also described yourself in the past as a Buddhist Christian. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Particularly, practice comes first. The Buddha says you don't have to decide first whether God exists or not, whether the soul is immortal or not, how the world began, before you can start to live the life. Start to live the life now, walk the way, and let the other things sort themselves out as you go along. That's a primary Buddhist doctrine, and I agree with it,
yeah.
Because I'm in some ways also a Christian Marxist. I want to put practice before theory.
Okay. Stephen Batchelor, the secular Buddhist author, once said that the closest affinity he has with another author in terms of his work is not a Buddhist, but you, presumably for similar reasons that you've just stated.
Yes, but I feel rather the same. It's very strange that Stephen went straight from school to the court of the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala,
yeah,
in India, and started his studies as a Buddhist monk at the Fountainhead, in a way. Whereas I had a completely establishment education, public school in Oxford, science and theology and philosophy. My education was Western establishment. His was completely different. But now, decades afterwards, we find ourselves with more or less the same views. And that's rather encouraging, because it leads me to think we might one day be able to evolve a religion for the whole of humanity, no longer sectarian at all. If I were to collaborate with Stephen, it would be on an attempt to describe a religion for all humanity.
You interpret Jesus as being a sharp critic of the secular-sacred distinction. Is this an example of the middle way?
Yes. Interestingly, although Jesus talks about the kingdom of God, all his parables are about ordinary life and about human relations between master and worker, or between parent and child or whatever, in ordinary everyday life. So in a curious way, Jesus seems to be saying, if you knew how to live ordinary life properly, you'd be in the kingdom of God, you'd be religiously completely happy. And I like that. I like the way people are returned into ordinariness to look at it again. That means that in my religion, there is no elite of experts with super insight into super truths. No, my religion is one for ordinary humanity in the middle of life.
Okay. What is your view of the middle way, Adon?
It's not quite in my vocabulary, but I do recognise from what I've read of Robert Ellis's ideas a certain affinity and similarity with what people like Stephen and I are saying. Yes, we've got to work away at developing as simple and clear a vocabulary as we can get to find something we can communicate to a secular age. You know, in the world we've got, people understand only fundamentalism. Any kind of novelty in religious thought they find very difficult and hard to understand. They prefer ultra-conservatives or whatever. I don't know, but instead, the point, by the way, I wonder if middle way people are, as I am, rather impressed by Pope Francis. It looks to me as if he does understand something of the fix that the Roman Catholics are in and something of the way out of it. He looks back to the teaching of Jesus and to Francis, and his freshness, his rather open-air quality, his common humanity, has excited ordinary people to a remarkable degree.
Yeah, well, I can only speak for myself here, Don, but I definitely see him as a breath of fresh air.
Yes, that's right. Too much of Roman Catholicism is very indoor and cave-like almost, you know, artificial, hyped up. And rather rigid, whereas Francis, of course, was a preacher in the open air, like Jesus, amongst ordinary people. And when the new Pope took the name of Francis, there was a hint of where his sympathies were, where his sympathies lie. How far he'll be able to get in the few years he has at the top, I don't know. That's going to be difficult. But one must wish him well, and much sympathy, and hope that he'll make real progress.
Okay, my last question, Don. We've touched on this a little bit earlier on, but could you just elaborate a bit more on what you're working on at the moment?
I'm doing something called Make It All Come True, The Primacy of Ethics in Religious Thought. And I'm contrasting the old religious way of thinking, which put doctrine first, and ethics as a response to doctrine, with a new way of thinking which puts ethics first and as its background simply has ordinary life. But doctrine comes second after ethics. So I'm trying to shift a bit both philosophy and theology because of my non-realism taking me more and more towards nihilism and the need for a fresh start. I'm looking to the imagination and to ethics to make that fresh start, both in religion and in philosophy. And thinking about the mess we were in after World War II and the mess that particularly Germany was in, one felt that all the old realities were destroyed. They destroyed themselves. Somehow, human beings have got to find a way of rebuilding. And in this new essay, I'm trying to indicate how I think it can be done.
And so are you, in a sense, advocating more an orthopraxy as opposed to orthodoxy.
Yes, I don't really want to prescribe an ethics much at all, except to say that the Buddha and Jesus, and perhaps Nietzsche too, wanted to live entirely without hostile feeling or resentment towards anybody. They wanted to get the antagonism and the suspicion and the envy and so on out of human relationships. So I like that tradition. I think we should find a way of renewing it for our own time. And by the way, there's one contemporary I should like to mention, because she's just becoming famous, and that is a Dutch Jewish woman who died in Auschwitz in 1942. Her name is Etty Hillesum. Her complete surviving works have just been published.
I'll have a look at that too. Well, thank you very much, Don. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. It's been really interesting.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.